Welcome to Your Body Has a Voice by Janine Roth, Part 2.
Kimberly, how you doing after telling everybody about... I just wanted to check in with you again because that was a open-hearted sharing that you did.
I am a bit tired, but I feel very centered. And I'm relieved in a way that it's out there because it allows me to be more congruent and not sort of dance around what I really mean. So I'm good.
So let me ask you a question, Kimberly, and tell me if you don't want to answer this. And I ask because I'm very curious about it. It seems like, and tell me if I'm wrong, okay? Because I knew you before you had cancer with your long blonde hair. And whatever you walked into the retreat with. And now I can see you, hear you, know you as you've gone through these transformations. It seems like having cancer has brought many things, many, many, many things. Not gonna pretend that it hasn't brought a whole host of other things other than what I'm gonna speak to right now. So I understand that it's brought so much. What you said this morning is that it's brought you to a place of gratitude, or let's just say appreciation, deep appreciation for having eyes that can still see sunrises and sunsets and your kids, and arms that can hold your grandkids, and a body that still carries you, that got you to this retreat. So my question is, if you had to choose, and of course it's a moot point, a life before without this gratitude, without this sensing and profound kiss the earth, I'm alive today, that got triggered or catalyzed by the knowledge that you had cancer. If you had to choose this or that...
I choose this.
Right. Why would you choose this?
Because I have me.
Right.
I have me. I know who I am. The question that you kept asking, who do you make yourself to be? Who do you think you are? And I could never answer that. I can answer that now. I have me in my strength and wisdom and fear and whining and joy. I love who I am. And I did not love who I was, that woman who walked in here in 2012.
Right.
It's not a choice. It's not a choice. My family was very angry because things were missed and I ended up where I am. But I had a summer where I thought I didn't have cancer. And because I had cancer and was theoretically in remission, I jumped into an icy cold lake with my niece on Memorial Day, and I loved the shock of the ice cold water. And I did not care that I was jumping next to a 20-year-old, slim, youthful. I was me, and I had my life, and we jumped into that water. And I had that moment, and that's what cancer has brought me, not worrying about the photograph, but being there with my niece, jumping into an ice-cold Minnesota lake.
It sounds like what it's brought you, Kimberly, is yourself. It's brought you awareness. And I'm going to come back to this in a second. The reason I'm bringing this up again is because this has everything to do with what we're doing here. Everything to do with what we're doing here. And so bear with me for a moment. Every time you stop eating when you've had enough, and you don't want to stop eating when you've had enough, every time you say no because you're listening to your body, but the whole mechanism is to keep going, every time you take a risk, every single time you go inside instead of going outside where you normally go, it's a little death. Every time you go to sleep at night and you go into dreamless sleep, you don't have a family. You don't have a life. You don't have a room. You're not thinking about your bed. You're in dreamless sleep. That's a death. We face death every single day and gloss right over it. Just gloss right over it, or else try to escape it. A major way we try to escape it is by using food. Every time you turn towards your discomfort rather than push it away. So a diagnosis makes you face something, or not. Some people don't. I had a really, really good friend who was sick or had cancer for 5 years, and up to the day she died, did not want to talk about death. Did not want to talk about it. I must have brought it up probably 5 or 10 times over the years, but I wasn't going to force anything. That didn't want to happen, so I stopped bringing it up. So there are many ways to deal with big deaths, little deaths, but what's important to know is that coming here, in a way, you're saying, okay, here I am, I have a chance to face what it's like to stop doing something I don't want to stop doing, or to start doing something I don't really want to start. There's an edge that we reach in ourselves with compulsive eating. There's a place that a lot of us don't want to go. We don't want to go there. We come here to go there, but then we're here and we don't want to go there because it's uncomfortable. And for everybody, it's a different place. For some people, it's, well, if it's a loss of control. For some people, it's, if I don't have a structured eating plan, that scares the hell out of me. Because who knows what's going to come up. For some people, it's, if I have a structure at all, that scares the hell out of me. So I don't want to have a structure. We reach an edge with eating. We reach a place where it feels like, no, I'm not doing it. I'm not going there. This is too much. You're asking too much. I'm not going to eat cold oatmeal. I'm not going to sit here like this. And the question that I have for you is, what's it like to realize that? What's it like? Tonight we're going to be going into silence. That's the death of talking. for a couple of days. That's going into leaning into silence. What's it like? I think the question is, well, let me ask you, Kimberly. I think I'm calling on you because it is, you have worked with your cancer in a way that has, you've tried everything there is to try. So it's not like you started this and said, I give up. I'm not doing this. I'm not going to fight. And you have turned your thinking, feeling, consciousness to what you do have. And we all can do that now. We can all do that now. The question is, as somebody said this morning, the answer was, it snapped me right out of it. How long is it going to snap you out of it, whatever it is? We all know the experience of having intense wake-up calls, almost being in a car accident, or being in a car accident, or getting sick, and then getting better. And then we say, it's never going to be like it was before. I'm always going to remember this moment. I'm always, always going to be grateful for the life I have, because there's something about living with that kind of understanding that we could have died, or somebody we know just died, that wakes us up. That's like jumping into a Minnesota lake in the freezing cold water. It wakes us up. It's like, oh my God, it was here the whole time. It's what Sarah said this morning. I keep wanting a mate, and I already have one. I keep wanting this life, and I already have it. Somehow a diagnosis or a tragedy or an almost tragedy or a catastrophe, or it could be your relationship with food. It could be that too, if you're willing to use it like that. It could be what you actually already have and why you're already here. You already came because you were suffering about that. You came because you wanted to stop suffering. That's why you came. Your suffering and the desire to end it brought you here. Now you get to figure out if that's what you're going to do here. Or are you going to pretend like you have more time? Are you going to keep pretending that you have all the time in the world? I know when I had anaphylactic shock from the contrast dye in a CAT scan, and I was starting to leave my body, and I was basically dying, and I would have died if they hadn't done emergency measures and epinephrine and brought me back and all of these very heroic measures that got me back in my body, which started immediately throwing up. And still I was glad for throwing up, because I realized when I was dying that I was dying. And I did not have one of those light experiences. I did not have a dying to be me experience. If you've read that book, an NDE, a near-death experience of seeing people I loved and, you know, knowing I was loved and everything was okay. I was a little pissed off at Matt, you know, because below me he was there and he was so scared that he wasn't proclaiming his undying love for me. And so I felt the slightest bit pissed off at him. How come? How could he? He was just petrified. And I was petrified. Well, I wasn't petrified. Actually, I wasn't petrified at all. I was just, whoa. I didn't think this was going to happen. Wow, I'm leaving my body. I should actually, you know, pay attention here. That's sort of what I was thinking. I should pay attention here. And as I've said to some of you, unfortunately, I had a lovely doctor, but he had a wandering eye. And he kept telling me to look at him, look at him. And I couldn't look at him because I couldn't decide which eye I should look at. And so it was like, look at me, look at me. But there was one eye going off in one direction and one eye looking straight. And it was like, whoa, I don't think I can look at you. This isn't working. Could somebody else come and tell me this? But of course, I couldn't talk. I couldn't say a thing because I actually had left. And when I was brought back and finished all the things, although many of you saw me right after that with a big face, I had the elephant, I called it the elephant man face. I came to a retreat and didn't know I was still having quite a reaction, and my face just kept blowing up, and I couldn't open one eye, and I had rash all over my face. But anyway, that ended. And I thought I'd never, ever, ever go back to taking anything for granted again. Ever. And within a couple of months, I sort of had forgotten about it. I'd forgotten about it. Living on that edge of appreciation and the urgency of it is a gift. It's a gift. There are, I always say, costs and benefits to everything. So the gift is that it wakes you up, and the gift of Kimberly being here is that it can oots you, as my mother would say, oots you into, okay, well, I don't know how long I have either. And some of you have already had cancer. 4 or 5 or 6 of you. You've already had that. You've already faced that. How are you living now? What's it like now? Can we live with that now? And the thing is, there's an edge of fear or terror of the unknown when anything familiar shifts. What's this going to be like? In that Mary Oliver poem, when death comes, what's it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? I don't want to leave this world angry and resentful, is what she says in there. I want to be a bride married to amazement. That's what she says. I want to be a bride married to amazement. What do you want to be? And it's not even about what you want to be. It's what are you now? Anything else you want to say, Kimberly, about the edge?
That practice has helped sustain me. So the practicing helped me convert the fact of cancer into something that is working for me.
Right. Yes. And it's amazing that given the choice, you would still choose this. And it's not so much that you would choose cancer as this aliveness. So if you were dead before the cancer and you're alive now with the cancer, who's dead and who's alive? Who's dead? If there's that sense of aliveness now, well, isn't that the fulfillment of any life? Being utterly alive? Thank you. What we practice with all the practices that we practice is aliveness. That's what the many practices are. They're practices of life, life force, aliveness. That's what we practice. Any questions before I move on? Questions, comments? Yes.
So in being here this time, things have come, have narrowed, like the, I can't remember, but like on the first day you were saying, the moment, am I still hungry or not? That's the whole thing now. Is, and it's really hard for me to tell. And I notice that I have a lot of reluctance. Like, I'd much rather stop full than a little bit hungry. I mean, I wouldn't rather, but I, that's the, you know, and there's a surprising amount of fear and intensity of feeling right in that moment.
Right. And that's what I was saying. Your edge and everybody's edge of fear or terror about this will be different. Everybody has an edge here that you come up against and you think, eh, maybe it wasn't such a good idea to do this anyway. You know, let me go back down a little bit here. Get back into a comfort zone. And so that's your edge. What would it be like to stop eating and see what comes up? See if terror is really so terrifying.
Yeah. I have been doing that. I really noticed that I don't actually know how full I am for a little while.
So, and so you're already practicing this.
Yes.
Good.
And I'm just surprised at how much, there's a lot of feeling packed in that little couple bites.
I got
it. It's shocking to me.
Yes, good. Good to see that.
Yeah.
Thank you. We have been speaking about and working with the same sort of key elements. And I'm going to go through the elements, or I like to call them the octaves at this point, because I think of it more like a spiral than a linear process. And we go around the spiral many times, and often it feels like, oh, here it is again. But it's a different octave. It's a different place that we're at when it comes around again than when it came around the first time. The purpose of this entire thing really is not to get done and be fixed forever, and that's it, nothing ever comes up. And the reason that that's not the purpose is because it can't be the purpose. Because life here on Earth School is filled with challenges. That's how it is. That's how it goes. We don't live in a heaven realm. Maybe there is a realm, as all the Buddhists say, that, you know, where there are no challenges, and I think they say there are no human bodies either, because having a human body comes along with inherent challenges. That's how it goes. We're born, that's the first challenge. The second challenge is we die. Birth and death are opposite. Life and death, not so much. Life and death are not opposite from each other. But birth and death, yes. When you're born, anything that takes a form also dies. We don't do this work to get to the end of challenges, because that will never happen. What does happen is our entire orientation shifts. So it's like a kaleidoscope that, if any of you have ever looked through a kaleidoscope, it's certain colors. In any kaleidoscope, it has a given amount of colors. That's it. You can get a different amount of colors with another kaleidoscope, but it's still fixed. You got the colors you got. But every time you change the thing, which I used to love as a kid, the whole pattern changes. The orientation to our experience and to the challenges that are implicit with having a human body and life here on our school absolutely changes. That's what changes. It becomes a different way to live so that you're not resisting your experience, but you understand it is the way it is, like Connie and I were discussing this morning at breakfast. These are certain givens. And what do you do about them? How you relate to and meet them is what changes utterly. That's what changes. Because most of our suffering is mind-made suffering, is suffering we create, then therefore your suffering gets reduced by 90%, if not more. That's what we do, or that's why we do what we do. That isn't what we do, but that is why we do what we do, to make life here on Earth School, implicit as the challenges are, be one that where your orientation is of, oh, here it is. Okay, here it is. And you're not at war with yourself and your own mind. You're not creating more war inside yourself and more war outside yourself. In, out, same thing. Just want to keep saying that, same thing. What we've been doing is using the 7 steps to freedom with food. We've been using those consistently in the eating meditations. Are you hungry? Can you taste the food? Certainly we've been eating without distractions. We've been eating sitting down. I've been asking you if you've had enough. So I've used all of those. Those are the beginning, middle, and end of this whole thing with food. They're all about food. They're always true in every situation, everywhere, from and until you die. They will always be true. That will be that. There's no question about those. They work in every situation. They also work for you to find out what it is exactly you want to eat. They're not about eat what you want, the way so many people have interpreted what I say and what I do as an excuse not to diet and therefore to binge. They're not about that. They're about discerning what your body wants, what your body really, really wants, what your body thrives on, what is life-giving, instead of what zaps your energy and depresses you and spaces you out and makes you not want to go to family gatherings. Those eating guidelines taken all the way will take you all the way through and out of the suffering of your relationship with food. They work all the time. Now, it is true that some people need and want more structure. You can have those as structured as you want them. I eat so differently than when I started this in 1978. It doesn't even resemble. What I eat now is not the same as what I ate then. It's not the same as what I ate 5 years ago. I keep on paying attention to, getting information from, and if I need to and want to, speak to healthcare professionals about what's going on in my body. And refining what I eat. Do I feel deprived? No. Would somebody look from the outside and think, wow, she's either on a diet or on some kind of very restrictive program compared to how I ate at the beginning, which was chocolate chip cookie dough, as much as I wanted, whenever I wanted, pumpkin ice cream for breakfast and lasagna whenever I felt like it and all of that. I interpreted the eating guidelines, even though I created them, my interpretation of them in those, definitely in the first couple of months, if not the first couple of years, was how to eat whatever I wanted to eat without guilt. And then when I realized I wanted to lose weight, because I was at my heaviest I'd ever been when I started this, and I realized I wanted to lose weight, I also figured out how I could manipulate them in order to lose weight. Or manipulate what I was eating. instead of having two scoops of pumpkin ice cream for breakfast, I had half a scoop of pumpkin ice cream for breakfast. Instead of having pizza for lunch, two pieces, I'd have one piece or half a piece. Instead of eating globs of cookie dough batter, I'd have a little cookie dough batter. And I lost weight very easily doing that. It was not hard to lose weight at all. It is not hard to lose weight. Well, particularly if you're a restrictor like me. But really, in general, what I've read about, you just cut your portions in half, whatever you're eating, cut them in half. I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying these work, but mostly they work because they teach you to trust what you've never trusted and take care of your body at the same time. They work. You have to figure out if you need more structure than the eating guidelines at first glance provide. Now, they provide that structure too. Never let it be said that if you follow the eating guidelines, if you follow the seven steps, they will take you to the same place. Same thing. You just have to pay a lot more attention to your body. That's the issue. When you're counting points, and ice cream is included in those points, well then, let's have ice cream because it's allowed. But if you're following the seven steps, then you're paying attention to what does ice cream feel like in my body? Oh, it doesn't feel so good. So even though I'm allowed to have it, my body doesn't feel so good when it does. That's the food part, which actually includes the entire rest of the second part that I'm going to tell you about, but because those are the whole world is in those. They're like Russian nested dolls. World within world within world within world within worlds. Because in order to follow what your body wants, you have to be in your body. In order to be in your body, you have to stop believing that your thoughts are true. In order to stop believing that your thoughts are true, you have to realize the suffering that listening to your thoughts causes you, which takes you back into your body. If you actually follow them in order to eat what your body wants, you have to discern how your body feels. In order to discern how your body feels, you have to sense what it feels like in your body. You have to be willing to ask yourself, what does it feel like? And the thing is, and this brings me over to the other things, the octaves. Fortunately or unfortunately, being in your body sometimes is about learning to be with discomfort. There's a willingness to tolerate, I got a pain in my knee, got an ache here, ooh, my joints don't feel so good. But that brings you back to what you're eating again. And brings you back to your body. So it's worlds within worlds within worlds. In terms of the inner practices that have nothing to do with food, when food isn't involved, what we practice, the five main practices that we follow, the first one is living in your body. That's a big one. Being in this body of yours, sensing what it's like, being interested. The second one has to do with crazy aunt in the attic. Has to do with understanding that there's a voice in the head. We all have voices in the heads, so not all of them are mean and shaming and judgmental voices, but many of us are totally glommed onto the mean and shaming voice, as if it's our voice. We believe it. And we can't tell the difference. And we, furthermore, we think that when it says to you, look at the size of your thighs, in that tone of voice, or you're disgusting, or your needs are repulsive, when it talks to us in that tone of voice, which most all of our voices do, and we hear that on, I mean, think about what it's like to hear that voice 24 hours a day. I mean, just think about it. Right, exhausting. It's just, it's talk about suffering and, you know, how to create suffering in yourself, listen to that voice, the crazy aunt in the attic. Listen to that voice. So the crazy aunt in the attic, disengaging. First of all, hearing and understanding that you have it. Secondly, is getting it how mean and shaming it is. Third is disengaging from it and not believing it, stopping it. The third octave is naming, exploring the parts of ourselves, the imprints. They're imprints, they're impressions of ourselves that have not been named, and also that we're identified with. So one way of saying this, the way we've said it before, is naming and exploring the ghost children, which is what I talked about with Oprah, ghost children. And the reason they're called ghost children is because many of us think about, and for a while it's easier to think about them as small, younger versions of ourselves that got frozen in time, whose feelings didn't get attended to. So if we were constantly told we were too big, I'm not talking about size-wise, our energy was too big, we were too energetic, we were too feisty, we were, you know, whatever it is, and told to pipe down. Not only do we have that voice, crazy aunt in the attic voice, pipe down, but we also have a part of ourselves, an imprint, an association of every time we start feeling happy or big energetically, where it's no, we got stopped in our tracks. And so that's a whole dynamic that goes on inside of us. That's a whole thing. That's not there. There are many ways, many times we got abandoned, rejected, because our parents weren't perfect and because their parents weren't perfect. My mother learned from her mother, who was 100 times worse in terms of one-liners and what could be construed as bitchiness and meanness than my mother. You know, when my mother first introduced my grandmother to my father when they were first dating, my father had a big smile, sort of like I do. And my grandmother said to my mother, "Most people have 32 teeth in their mouth. Why does he have 64? And my mother was like, "Whoa, I guess my mother doesn't like the man that I've just met." So there were edges to that, constant one-liners. You know, if I look at my mother, she doesn't ever say things like that. More, it's about forgive and forget. And I'm sure that my grandmother learned it from her mother. And because there was a lot of toughness, they escaped from Russia and pogroms. And, you know, it wasn't about inner states. It was about how do we survive? And it was about being tough. And it was about not turning towards your feelings at all, because your feelings didn't count. You had to get out of Russia with your life. Otherwise, you were going to die. There are good reasons for all of it, and here we are. With those voices inside of us, what do we do? And with our reaction to those voices. So my mother was treated like her feelings didn't matter, and then I was treated in a similar way. So there were many feelings I had that never got acknowledged or worked through, because they were wrong, they were bad. And I was going to lose my mother's love if I kept going. So I got stopped in my track. So there's been a lot of work to go back and reclaim the disowned feelings. We call that naming and being kind to the ghost children. Now, we're moving out of calling them discrete part so that we're inhabited by a crowd of children. It's not like that. We are not inhabited by a crowd of little children. Seriously, we're not. There wouldn't be any room in our bodies for the amount of impressions and associations. Sometimes it's helpful as a tool to realize that there were feelings that got stopped and that it's helpful to go back and scoop them up. This goes in tandem with the next octave, so to speak. What Laura and I did this morning, which was naming what was going on. We didn't call it a ghost child, but we named it. What's happening? Oh, there's a part of myself that doesn't feel joy. That's joyless and that wants joy and really keeps turning towards it. So naming that. And then the next thing we did together, Laura and I, together, was that we showed kindness. We turned towards those feelings. The radical step of turning towards what Laura said, well, when I feel that, I want to eat sugar. The radical step of turning towards what we want to avoid. And that is a practice and it's a process and it goes against all of human conditioning. It goes against what it took to survive, the evolutionary impulse. Not now, because the evolutionary impulse now is actually to start turning towards this. Because unless we do, there's going to be no more human evolution. We're not going to be here anymore. We've come as far as we can by warring with each other. And it may not be over yet. The weapons keep getting bigger, and it used to be people fought with sticks, and now we have nuclear bombs. So who knows what's going to happen? And it doesn't, on some level, it doesn't matter. Not right here, right now, because now it's turning that ship around, turning the Titanic around. This is the Titanic. The desire and the impulse based on millions of years of conditioning, of turning away to turn towards. That's the fourth octave or fourth element. And the fifth is the God part, so to speak. Many people say, well, where's the God part of Women, Food, and God? Well, just so you know, I only called it Women, Food, and God to get people's attention. It worked well, very well, to the point where my publishers keep saying to me, can't you come up with another title like that? No, I already did that. This is not then. I did it so that people would know, I'd get people's attention so that they would realize this is not about women and willpower. This goes so much far beyond it. This has to do with everything. And the only one word I could think of besides everything and that included the depth dimension, the spiritual dimension, what remains when all this mind stuff is gone, is the word God. Not the God of long white hair and the person in the sky and the one who punishes you and the one who's in heaven, if there actually is a heaven. Loren just gave me a cartoon the other day of this person going to heaven, and in the seat of St. Peter's seat, this big throne, was a dog. A dog was sitting there. And the dog said to the person who had just gone there, didn't the ever-loving, always faithful, always happy, always joyful nature of dogs give you a clue? So that's what remains. What remains when the four octaves are being worked with is like the nature of dogs, but in a human, a self-reflective nature. It is joyful. It is goodness itself. It is a lack of separation from anything or anyone else. Izzy is always happy to see me, even if she's just saw me 5 minutes ago. I can always get her to play with me. I just have to talk in a particular voice, run around the couch a couple of times, and she starts running around the couch, and it's like, playtime, yay! Puppy bows! And then I do a puppy bow, and she does a puppy bow, and then I do a puppy bow, and then she's wagging her tail and barking, and it's all fabulous fun. Incredible, but it's not that we're always wagging our tails, or you know, our metaphorical tales, but it's that even what isn't okay is okay. We trust in the essential goodness of life. We trust that it will be okay. And when it seems like the end of the world, there is a trust that comes in. We know it because we've experienced it directly over and over and over again by this time. And we trust that, okay, I can take a breath here. It's going to be okay. I don't see how it's going to be okay. This is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. I don't get how it's going to be okay. It's not okay now. But I've had enough practice with horrible things, seemingly horrible things, being okay. Not because somebody who's dying or died comes back to life, but because you get to see that even though they've died, they're still alive. So it's not alive in the sense that still with you. Who dies? Whoever dies. My father died in 2000. He's not dead. His form is dead. Is he dead? No. He's with me a lot of the time. So what dies is the form, and that's all that dies. And we get so attached to forms that we confuse the form with the essence. Which is why we are very sad when a particular food is gone. Or a flower dies, or any form ends. My favorite pair of shoes get a hole in them. Sad, but of course, I already bought a second pair long before they wore out. So, and why is that? To avoid the grief. Usually, sometimes, if I do that, I almost did that recently, and then I realized, no, I'm not going to do that for two reasons. One, I'm avoiding the grief. I'm eating for the hunger to come, so to speak. And third is, I might not like these by the time these wear out. That's what happens sometimes. I've bought two of something, and by the time I get to use it, I don't want it anymore. That's like stocking up on your favorite food, only to realize that three bites into it, doesn't taste so good. We see that it's going to be okay even when it isn't okay. We see the goodness, inherent goodness of life itself. Not a particular life situation in the moment, but life itself. It usually turns out, it works out, it turns out for the best. Now, had I not had the childhood I had with a drug and alcohol addiction, had there not been physical violence and cruelty, I never would have written the books that I wrote. I wouldn't have. I wouldn't be sitting here. You wouldn't be sitting here. Now, do I therefore say, yay, mom, yay, dad, so glad you... No. It's not the same as approving of it or condoning it. That's not the same. It's the understanding that A plus B, when to C. It's the understanding that that prompted me, urged me, and I wasn't going to stop until I felt clear, until I felt everyday joy for no reason at all. I wasn't stopping, still not stopping. Still think it's the best thing ever to keep looking and discovering. There's just nothing better. I still feel that way. Would I be so fervent and passionate and committed to this if it weren't for, at this point, the hell I went through? And knowing when you talk, I got it completely. I understand. I mean, it's not far away from me to go right to the depths of hell. Now, some might call it that. Janine, you didn't experience the depths of hell. You were never on the street. You weren't murdered. Right, I'm not murdered. That was true. I'm here. You weren't raped repeatedly. There are a lot of things that I wasn't. But it was depths of hell as far as I knew it, and it prompted me enough to work my way out of it and to be here with you. And as far as I'm concerned, that was a good outcome. Different than condoning, but understanding that there was good there as well. And also that my mother loved me, really, really loved me. Same with my dad. It wasn't love that I felt translated as love, but nonetheless. So those are the 7 steps, the 5 octaves. There you have it. The beginning, middle, and end of all the work we do. Everything we do refers back to those. Every single thing we do, every word we utter, it's all about that.
If you would like more information on Janine's retreats, workshops, or lectures, visit her website at www.janineroth.com. That's www.janineroth.com. Other audios, DVDs, CDs, and all of Janine's books are available for your support at her website. This audio is copyrighted by Janine Roth.